Hi, everybody. Welcome to our SIPL seminar with Lillian Edwards. Lillian is Emerita Professor at Newcastle and an Honorary Professor at the University of Glasgow. She was the editor, or is in fact still the editor, and major author of Law, Policy and the Internet, which is one of the leading textbooks in internet law. I have a copy. It's very good.
It's very good update.
It's well.
It's true. It's
okay. Okay. Well, we can fix
something
that.
Lillian
has been working in, I guess, broadly speaking, IT law, technology law, then e-commerce law, then data protection law, now AI law for a number of decades. Eons, we can go with eons. And her work has been enormously influential, I think, in many, many different areas. One particular example is in the early work Lillian did to develop the concepts of data trusts, which have now become part of European law and are now in EU legislation. But also through working in this field for eons, let's say, her work has influenced the work, I think, of many other people who have come after her. So we're very pleased to have Lillian here today to talk about generative AI and the right to an explanation. So instead of me going on, I'm going to pass you over to Lillian and she can take us through her presentation. Thank you very much.
Where are the people who are online? Oh, there they are. Okay. Just so they can see me. Hello. Okay, right. Well, there's an awful lot in this talk, probably at least two talks worth, and I have tried to cut it down. But since there's so few of us, if at any point you feel like, oh, that's going too fast, or we don't need that, then do say, okay? Can I just get a very quick idea? I know it's a very small room, but, you know, is anyone here not a lawyer? Apart from Bill.
Very long time ago.
Is anyone here a proper computer scientist? Oh, who are you? I didn't realize that. Okay.
I have a diploma from Cambridge. Does that count?
No. Well, I don't know. I think Jennifer can advise you on that. So I have my MSc from York, but all it's now good for is knowing the difference between a variable and a constant, as I usually say. Okay, right. Less of the wine, Bill. Okay, what's this about? I just gave this talk actually in Germany where no one had watched The Traitors, to my utter horror, because I didn't watch The Traitors either, but I actually watched the last of the series, The Celebrity Traitors, purely so that I understood my own PowerPoint, because I did notice that this was an opportunity and I'm never short of coming forwards for a bad joke to get in some unfortunate puns. So let me just explain. Oh, does that not work? Oh, right. Okay. Sorry. It's not like I'm used to. So the root of this is that I was asked to do something in Florence about all the various rights of explanation that have been polluting the infosphere, if you like, or making us a better place in the last few years. And while I was at it, I thought, okay, I know about the right of explanation to some extent in relation to conventional machine learning. I've been talking about it at least since 2016. Has the arrival of large language models made any difference, or are they just bigger? So therefore, I set out, did a bit of Googling, as I unscientifically did, and I found this paper, which slightly blew my mind, which is something that doesn't happen so often, you know, when you've got old and cynical. So this is a paper by a Harvard team. I don't know if anyone else has seen it. It turned out Jeremias Pressel Adams had, which blew my mind as well, about faithfulness against plausibility. And what they're talking about is a phenomenon where we are now developing large language models that are built in such a way that they claim to be intrinsically explaining themselves, self-explaining or reasoning or, you know, intrinsically interpretable. I don't think this is true. but that's the story. But what a very large number of computer scientists, it turns out now, not just these guys, have discovered is that there is a kind of conflict in these new chain of thought reasoning models as to whether the explanations that they're built to produce are actually true. So that's the faithfulness part, as in, do they faithfully represent the underlying stuff in the inerts, in the weights and the network and the trained algorithms that have led to the answer or the decision or the output? Or do they just give you something which is pleasantly comprehensible, which is plausible, you know, which in human terms is kind of legible, is understandable, right? So that's, and I won't call it the trade-off because I'm not sure if it is, but that's the conflict here between faithfulness and plausibility. And that's what led me to think about faithful and traitors, right? So I'd say, yeah, don't roll your eyes, Jennifer. It's the last time I'll mention it. Yeah, there you go. You know, you want to have a picture. And anyway, I'm known for putting needless media references into my stuff. Huh. So that's why that's there. But that's the end of that. Okay. However, the concept itself I found very, very interesting, and therefore I went off and read about 10,000 XAI papers over the course of about the last 3 weeks, because it was something I knew about once but hadn't really looked at again since about 2018. So this is the ground I was planning to cover. I may not get through all of it. So here's the thesis, as it were, laid out, which is firstly, there is a lot of interest in transparency and specifically in rights to an explanation. Okay, and I have a few slides about that, but it's now not just the GDPR, it is also the Platform Workers Directive or Work Directive, and it is also now famously, of course, in the EU AI Act, and you could argue even in the Digital Services Act, though I'm not going to talk about that one. So you could say that the right to an explanation is important. And what kind of explanations are large language models going to give us, right? Because we're now using them for everything, including making the tea. So this is going to be very important, particularly, I would say, and I hope Jennifer might agree, in their use in the public sector, where they are going to be any minute now, God bless the Tony Blair Institute, in charge of, you know, giving us our welfare benefits, our taxes, our immigration entry, our COVID vaccine disclosure, anything you care to name is going to be coming that way so that we can sack everybody in the public sector and save money, right? So it's not, I think, unimportant. Now that leads us to the point that I've been making, which is, if large language models are going to be start to be used this way, and Solon Barocas was talking really interestingly about this in Tubingen, that up till now we thought of large models as very much producing cultural products, producing text, producing student essays, producing, you know, photos and stupid anime art and all the rest of it. But in fact, what they're doing is they're replacing what we used to think of as conventional machine learning and, in fact, conventional rule-based or symbolic systems, because they're easy, they're cheap, they're available, you know, they're practically free to use to some extent. And therefore, the other day, to give an example, I probably shouldn't say this in public, but I had to file accounts for my company that makes almost no money, and I was considering closing it. And then I thought, no, I will get ChatGPT to do my accounts. And it did. It also, at that point, went into chain of thought reasoning, which we will get to. There was no money. So there wasn't much to lose in this, and it would have cost me £300 to get the accounts done. But this is the kind of thing people are using large language models for now that no one ever thought would happen, okay? So again, if I do this and I have to explain it to the Inland Revenue or someone, or if it goes wrong and I want to know why it's gone wrong, again, I'm really keen on a bit of transparency, a bit of explanation. So this is how we have a growth, among other reasons, in this idea of self-explaining large language models, which brings to mind all these words that get thrown around, like chain of thought, chain of logic. So then we have this conflict that I've already described, between faithful explanations and plausible explanations. And when I originally proposed this talk, it was going to be all about one, because I thought I'd do something that was nice and legal for Cambridge. But in the end, the talk is primarily really about two and three, because they're the more interesting part to me. But we do have, as I've already moaned, we do have this new case, which has got an awful lot in it, called Dun & Bradstreet from, I think, February this year, which is about the right to an explanation and what it means and what meaningful information is and so forth and so on. And it made me think this was the other kind of light bulb that went off. So now you have the whole talk, really. The rest just fills in the gaps. Which is where, which direction is the law heading in, right? Is the law heading in the right direction in terms of the kind of explanation it mandates, at least within these European legal instruments that I'm talking about? This is not a talk about the English legal system, okay? Although obviously, so at least two people here know that the UK, England and Scotland and so forth have the GDPR. So in some respects, all of this is almost as relevant in terms of transferable metaphors of interpretation. Okay. So I'm going to go through this at the speed of light. And if you don't know this stuff, then sorry. It's all my book from 2018. So once upon a time back in the day in 2016, oh my God, these two people who were, I think, computer scientists or economists or something, had a look at the GDPR and said, oh my God, it gives people a right to an explanation of algorithms. You know, this is when we were still very shiny and excited about machine learning, about neural networks, you might call it, about anything that was moving on from a rule-based, explicit, symbolic, interpretable, comprehensible model of software, right? And people were going on and on at that time, as I'm sure you know, about software, about the new machine learning being a black box, right? Because in the middle was not rules in English or in COBOL or something like English, but weights, networks, so forth. Okay, so at that point, this little storm, this is just really for my sake to be fun, this little storm of articles came out. This was fun times in which we all argued about whether these two people were right or wrong. If you roll forward to now, this was my attempt to, believe me, I really tried to get this down onto one slide. A lot of these discussions revolve around two articles in the GDPR. One is Article 22. And the other, at least for my purposes here, is Article 15.1H. Now, a lot of the storm and, you know, storm and furore was around Article 22, which on the face of it appeared to be nothing to do with explanations, but actually an article that protected you from a computer making a decision about you that was important without your say-so, right? And you go, I always say this to my students, you go like, what, why is this like such a big deal in terms of transparency? Well, the reason is because in this version of the article, you're right not to be subject to a decision based solely on automated processing was sometimes removed by certain conditions. But even if it was legal to subject you to solely automated processing, decisions made by solely automated processing, the decision maker still had to provide safeguards. There was a list of the safeguards. And then in the recitals, which in themselves are, broadly speaking, persuasive rather than mandatory, there was a statement that these safeguards should include the right to obtain an explanation of the decision. And that was what thousands and thousands of words of ink were spilled about. Meanwhile, there was a much simpler route, it appeared, to get to the same kind of idea, which had been sitting there for, you know, decades in the GDPR and before at the DPD, which was in Article 15, which was the right to obtain meaningful information about the logic involved. Now, as I was just saying, there is a kind of argument to be had there about whether this necessarily is subject to the same restrictions that are over the page as Article 22. And I'll mention why it's kind of important. It's also important that Article 15 has got a big carve out there for trade secrets. So in practice, this is there's little but this that Americans talk about. You know, the fact that you can have all these wonderful rights in Europe, but, you know, they're not going to tell you. They're not going to tell you their secret source, etc. Whereas we don't talk as much about that over here, I think. So this is, and I'm only going to mention the bit that's important. This is why I think this link between Article 22 and Article 15 thing is important, because Article 22 is quite delimited in ways you might not have suspected if you were a non-lawyer. Firstly, it's not totally clear what a decision is. And I think that may become very relevant when you're talking about large language models, you know, which we think of as producing content. Is content a decision? You know, so, but as I say, it's being used in ways that clearly are decisions. But the most important bit is number two, which is this idea that it only gives you these rights in relation to a solely automated processing decision. And there's a lot of argument about that in different countries, different data protection agencies, et cetera. We seem to be sliding towards a slightly more sensible position, which is that if there is substantially no human input, if the human judge, say, is just rubber stamping a prediction about recidivism, then that should count as a solely automated decision. But it's still not really in solid European law, I would argue, yeah? It's there in some parts of some rulings in the Netherlands and Portugal and a few other places. But then there's other case law that seems to go the other way. So that's quite a limitation, because in the real world, nearly every single high stakes decision that is taken by clever automated software is not solely automated, right? And it's going to move from a spectrum of judges standing at a reluctant distance, letting the machine do its thing, to immigration officer is using a system. This is Simona Demkova's example, that's trained on EU databases about immigration entry, and they're using it and it's scoring and it's red flags, but they're also sort of using their own memory of who they've let in the past and things like that. So that starts to look very not solely automated. It starts to look semi-automate, right? So I just want you to sort of remember that. Tuck it behind your ear. Right, then we get to this case I'm talking about. I found this while trying to make PowerPoint take a GIF, which I could not do. That's how technical and AI-y I am. So I gave up and settled for a still. So this is every data protection lawyer in the world getting the news that Dun & Bradstreet had actually finally explicitly and with no compunctions recognized the existence of the right to an explanation. So all that time we spent writing articles about it was a complete waste of time. We just needed to sit around for 9 years, as is often the way with European law. So in Dun & Bradstreet, they say, the court says, the right to obtain meaningful information must be understood as a right to an explanation. This is spelling it out in words even lawyers could understand, of the procedure and principles actually applied. Now, that's interesting. There's a reason that's in bold. In order to obtain a specific result. Sorry, I should be keeping an eye on time. When did we start?
Wait, 22 years.
Okay, well, keep me on track, okay? So we want about another 20 minutes, yeah? Something like that. Or less, but it's unlikely. So I'll come back to this. But one thing it does very clearly, I think, is it refers to a right of an explanation of a particular decision of a particular data subject in particular circumstances. It's not, as has been floated by various people in another place, only giving you a right to a general description ex ante of the characteristics of the system. It's giving you what seems a much more natural right to me of the right to explanation of your own decision that's affected your own rights or your own status. But it then goes on in what is a very uncontroversial way, as I will demonstrate, within conventional legal guidance, history, jurisprudence, to say that the information should be concise, transparent, intelligible and easily accessible. And as I will show, this is a formulation of words that comes up in slightly different ways or the same ways over and over again in the jurisprudence, because it's all deriving from early statements about how transparency should be done, particularly in Recital 58 of the GDPR. So coming back to that in a minute, I just want to note, just to back up my statement that the right to an explanation is increasingly important, that we do see it coming up in other directives and regulations now. So after the GDPR, after we'd fought over the GDPR for long enough to get our ref articles out, then came the Platform Work Directive, which is infinitely better, which I believe I know who wrote different bits of it, and it's spectacularly good, right? So what it almost is, I sometimes say, is fix it fan fiction for the GDPR Article 22. You know, it's like they've taken a mess and they've sort of fixed it. So what it says, I shouldn't really go into this because there isn't really time, but they've taken out the solely. Forget the solely. They've also taken out, interestingly, the word meaningful, and they've left clear and plain language, which helps us a bit, as we'll see later, in what it becomes a patent conflict, I think, between meaningful and clear and plain and intelligible, right? And it does this interesting thing of, and this is, I think, unique in any of these provisions, maybe not in some public law provision somewhere, of saying that not only should there be an explanation, but there should be someone who can explain it to you. There should be someone, you know, who can almost explain the explanation, some kind of trained contact person. Now, this, of course, remember, is in the context of gig workers and gig platforms. So you're talking very alienated, marginalized, remote working, you know, in situations of very strong imbalance of power usually. So it's a really good thing to have in there. And after the Platform Work Directive, we have the, God bless it, the EU AI Act, which is almost not worth talking about at this point since it's being pulled out from under our feet as we sit here. But I've got a chapter ready to go on it, so I'm going to talk about it. So Article 86 of the AI Act is a funny little article that was shoved in quite near the end of the process, and I actually didn't notice for several months. And again, we are back in sort of Jennifer's terrain here, because to some extent, this is really meant to help us with the idea of obligations adhering to the AI value chain, right? Not just to the provider at the top who makes the model and then goes home with the money, but the various deployers down the chain, the employers, the lawyers who use it to make a chatbot, the public sector local authority offices and the immigration offices who, you know, use some kind of model to deliver their own stuff without really understanding it. So in AI Act terminology, these people are all called deployers, right? The people who use the model but don't make it ab origo. And again, I won't go through this. I'm sorry it's so messy, but I haven't really got a reason for that. It just is. But in fact, what this is showing is that this is a really Frankenstein-like provision where bits of it seem to have been, you know, taken out on the back of an envelope of Article 22, which, as we have already said, is deeply problematic. Bits of it seem to have been invented on the fly. Bits of it are a bit of both almost. And I think main elements, I don't know why it's in pink, I think that's been taken perhaps from jurisprudence. But the interesting bit actually about this is the bit at the bottom, because I think most people who cared, which is like seven people, thought this doesn't really matter because there's this huge carve out that it only applies if the right isn't already provided under EU law. So everyone who'd been in the Article 22, Article 15 bushes said, well, AI is made of personal data. Well, we're not all you, David. You know, I'm speaking here for the massive. Everyone who was used to the GDPR said, well, the GDPR covers almost all of this because AI is made with personal data, and therefore this has no point to it, really. But in fact, this isn't true, I would argue, because some of these decisions will be made not using personal data, but that's maybe a little abstruse. But I think most importantly, because many decisions are semi-automated and will not be covered by the GDPR Article 22 or arguably Article 15. Okay. So if you take it, I think I have this over the way. Yeah. If you take it that this is going to be used by deployers who are going to be largely for our purposes in a country like the UK, the important people, right? We don't have very many model providers. We have deployers. We have employers and law firms and public sector workers and all the rest of it. If they are providing semi-automated decisions, which they mostly will be, then Article 86 would be the relevant one. Of course, it doesn't apply in the UK, so this is a toy example, but, you know, substitute France or Belgium or whatever. So once you get to there, you go, well, is that going to be useful? And the answer is probably not, because, again, in this little piece that Demkova wrote, and she is meant to be writing a longer version of it, which I'm waiting for with, I think, Michelle Fink, she says providers aren't going to be able to tell you. They're not going to be able to explain the decision. You're right back to the same old problem, that they don't understand what's in it. They probably don't have access to the innards. They're probably getting it by an API. They might have bought it off the peg at a cheap rate because it came as part of Teams or something. And they're very unlikely to be able to provide this adequately without a joint effort with the providers, which will often not be there. So that's one point. But the main point that I'm looking at here is that, if you go back to that, sorry, it sets up exactly the same tension that we had in the GDPR between clear and meaningful. And it didn't really occur to me till I started looking at this faithful versus plausible thing, that these are not the same thing. You know, that meaningful means it understands the meaning of the underlying system. You know, it's more than that, but that's part of it. Whereas clear means, you know, you, me, and Joe Bloggs over there understands it. You know, it's transparent in that sense, like class. And although it didn't look that way, I think, in the early days of the GDPR, they now look a lot like the opposites. So what are these people going to do, right? The employers and the immigration officers and all the rest of it. What's going to become very appealing at this point is going to be this new generation of large language models that are said to reason or be self-explaining, because then you're not going to need your in-house person, as in the platform work directive, that can somehow delve into the innards of OpenAI, which they won't have access to anyway, and explain what's going on. So, right, this takes me to the technical part, and I've got like 15 minutes to explain the really difficult part, but that's good. It means I can go over bits and you can ask me questions. So if you think about large language models, as opposed to your like 2016, 2018, big data, old fashioned, small data, conventional machine learning model, is there a really crucial difference going on here? You've got the same old black box problems. They're not rule-based, they're not linear, they're complex, they've got 8 trillion billion parameters. So they're obviously more complex and more difficult to understand than conventional machine learning. I think that's pretty obvious. And so people have been designing these explicitly interpretable large language models. Now, one point here that I don't want is kind of a side point that I would like to discuss at some point, but would, is how far does the trade secret problem reoccur here? Because Anthropic already said, well, we're not going to tell you the whole explanation. We're just going to give you a bit of it so as to protect our competitive advantages. They said that out loud, you know, in TechCrunch in May this year. But the point that I'm really interested in comes back to this. Okay, so let's just define terms very quickly, which is, I'll start with the one on the right, actually. An explanation is considered faithful if it accurately represents the reasoning of the underlying model. Okay, I think these are decent definitions. On the left, an explanation is considered plausible if it is coherent with human reasoning and understanding. In other words, it says kind of what we expected it to say. You know, if you ask me, why is the sky blue? I'll probably say because the sun is out. I won't say because there's a scattering of the rays across the spectrum in the oxygen with the atoms bouncing off each other, which is probably the more technically accurate description. So sometimes those are both right, and sometimes one is right and one is wrong. And sometimes there is no right and wrong, you know, and you cross the zebra crossing and you get knocked down. So this is also from the same paper, I'm afraid. I will find other sources when I write it up. But this was a useful little table showing you three different types of the ways that large language models are now being built to be interpretable. Now, these two, which are probably better known, been around for longer. Indeed, counterfactuals have been around since the good old days of 2016 and whatever. Well, much, much longer, I think, are post hoc, right? You build your model and then you explain it to the punters using these techniques, right? The interesting one to me that I didn't really understand before I read these thousands of papers is chain of thought. Now, some of you may have seen chain of thought. I think I've got an easy example here, right, that I made earlier. No, I didn't. I stole from another paper. And this idea of chain of thought is that the model doesn't just give you the answer. It shows its work, right? It shows you its reasoning, which seems, again, like an intuitively good idea, and some of you may have seen it. And as I say, it started doing this to me when I asked it to do it with my company accounts. To my amazement, it started saying, well, you know, if this is there, then this is your profit and this is your loss. And I went, I didn't ask for all this. I just wanted you to print me out a PDF. And why did they invent these? Well, initially, it was nothing to do with explanations. It was to prevent hallucinations, or at least to try to reduce hallucinations, because there were a number of, you know, good papers, good work by computer scientists showing that if you allowed the LLM to have some scaffolding in a way as it produced its result, almost feedback to itself, then it could avoid the most egregious hallucinations, the most complete going off piste. That's good. They also did it because they were going through a really embarrassing phase of discovering that these things usually got maths wrong, usually got arithmetic wrong. And there was quite a lot of evidence that chain of thought was helping them to stop doing that, stop producing results like 2 + 2 = 5, because it would have to in some way tell itself what it was doing when it added 2 to 2 and so forth. Okay, so that was the original idea. But naturally, I think, when you see this, people start regarding it as a form of interoperability, as a form of external explanation facilities to use this, right? And indeed, that is how it got taken up like crazy, as this guy Barres has documented. And then a lot of papers come out saying this isn't a very good idea, because actually chain of thought isn't an explanation. It's often misleading. It's often untrustworthy. It's often a traitor. It's a mirage. And I particularly love this one. It's decoration, you know, as if you had a real answer and then you just sort of hung tinsel on it to make people feel better about it. And finally, in April this year, Anthropic, who I think maybe had been the initial developers of chain of thought, were very sold on it, came out with a blog saying, actually, our reasoning models don't always say what they think. In other words, they tell lies. So just to give I've had two examples. I've taken one out, actually, to give one example, okay, of what happens. These are non-mathematical problems. You might call these high-stakes problems. It's about crime. It's about race. It's subjective, if you like. A human would make some kind of subjective reasoning about these problems, right? They both depend on two pieces of weak evidence. One is that somebody was fiddling around in their pockets, and one is that somebody was asking about prices. In both cases, the same result is given by the chain of thought, which is that the black man is the person who's trying to buy drugs. But the reason in each case is different. The chain of thought has played with the evidence to, in each case, in a kind of fantastic post-rationalization, would make a good lawyer, produce the result that the actual training data has produced in the model, which is obviously historic bias, that the black man is the one who's most likely to be trying to buy drugs, right? So it's an absolutely glorious example. And I had another one about leap years in 1776, but you'll have to find that one yourself. So why is this? Why would anyone build models like this? Well, there's two reasons. One is that LLMs are particularly built and trained to be persuasive to humans in this very easily understood dialogue conversational style. And that does lead them to look for a plausible delivery, even if it's not the accurate one, right? That's how they're built. That's how they're trained. So similarly on the training, the fine tuning is all based, you know, do you give it a tip? Do you say this is a better explanation? Do you say this is a better result? On what is convincing and plausible to the human evaluators, right? Most of whom are probably not experts in every field. So you end up with what I think is very beautifully called, as well as hallucinatory answers, you end up with hallucinatory explanations, or what Ajwani calls adversarially helpful. And that's what it's helpful, but it's not. Now, this isn't brand new for LLMs. We've actually seen examples of non-faithful explanations since there was one I just happened to know because I'm old, from 1998. But of course, large language models are much more convincing about it because they speak in really, really good natural language that's very convincing and very easy to read. So what does that get us to? I'm going to come back to the law in a minute and then stop. Promise. It gets us to a conflict. I'm just coming down here between plausibility, which gives you misplaced beliefs, and misplaced over reliance. That's the bad thing. So there's this lovely example, which actually was in the European Data Protection Supervisor report on human oversight. It's not where I expected to find it, and is one of the very few examples of a top legal agency being in any way convinced that explanations shouldn't just be, as they always have been, you know, clear and human-y and, you know, understandable and all this stuff. Someone actually smelling that something weird is going on here. And he dug up, or his team dug up, this study, which is actually pre-LLMs, that clinicians who were given different treatments, different types of antidepressant treatments, they were given incorrect recommendations as to the best treatment for the case study. But they were given easily interpretable explanations for these. Again, this is rather brilliant. I would just like to make these cases up. And the clinicians, given this combo, made fewer accurate decisions as to treatment than the people who were just presented with the options. So in other words, bad explanations lead to bad decisions, which isn't really that surprising. And that's what we're getting out of chain of thought. But on the other hand, you've still got this problem, which is what law has always anticipated, that if your explanation is faithful, then maybe no one can understand it, and it makes them confused and hostile and, you know, don't believe the explanation either, and AI becomes untrustworthy and so forth and so on. And if you're a doctor or a lawyer, you can't explain what your system is doing to your patient, your client, your stockholder, you know, and then you're screwed. So neither are very good. So at this point, I stop and go back to the law. And as I say, the law very largely has preferred plausibility over faithfulness, right? That's what it says again and again and again. And why does it say that? Well, apart from the obvious that we never realized these things were a conflict before, because of GDPR Recital 57, which says that the principle of transparency requires that any information be concise, easily accessible. This, you've heard this all before, easy to understand, and clear and plain language be used, right? So clear, comprehensible, plausible. And that then feeds into all of the various bits of guidance I could have left on the ICO and various others, but I didn't because there's too much. Right. And then we get to Dun & Bradstreet, which is really our first serious CJEU case on this. And Dun & Bradstreet, I'm afraid there is no big turnaround surprise at the end of this, follows the usual line, you know? So here we are. We have a statement, as I've already said, that there is a right to an explanation, that you can find it in some unholy alliance of Article 15 and Article 22, and that means that the explanation must be in a concise, transparent, intelligible, and easily accessible, whatever that means, form. And the reason for this, which again recurs, as we've seen, in the Platform Work Directive, in prior transparency cases about Articles 13, 14, 15, is that this is because these rights of transparency are about contestation. They're about having the ability to find out what's been done with your data and then to challenge it or contest it or reverse it or rectify it, right? So that all makes sense. There's this interesting statement in Dun & Bradstreet, which has a lot in it, that the complexity of the operations involved in the automatic processing, the automated decision-making, doesn't nonetheless mean that the data controller doesn't have to do all this, doesn't have to provide an explanation in a concise, transparent, intelligible, and easily accessible form. Now, that begs the question, which is that if in some of these large language models you cannot do this, you cannot actually, given the complexity, produce a clear explanation that is actually faithful, does that mean you shouldn't produce an explanation at all? Or you shouldn't actually be allowed to use this kind of processing, right? So there's a few more things on that page that I'm going to come back to in a minute. But I just want to get to the last bit. Now, this is the just a follow-up, just to say that people are beginning, I think, very slightly to wake up to the fact that saying all explanations should be nice and clear and simple and human comprehensible is not the end of the story with LLMs. So here we have the European Data Supervisor, and also we have CDT interested in the position of employers as deployers. Like, how are they going to do this? I've gone past it, haven't I? No, it's here. This is because I took things out. The interesting bit, I think, for us especially, is if we find that we are... Now, I have missed something. Where was it? Oh, there it was. Yeah, sorry, I missed that bit at the top. If we're interested in high stakes, expert domain answers or reasoning, as I think we are, if, you know, in this room, we're interested in law, perhaps medical advice, these kind of pieces of advice, okay? Your rights, your public sector rights, so forth, right? These are high stakes, non-mathematical, subjective in the sense of being dependent on reasoning by experts that could have gone either way depending on the evidence and perhaps the biases. You might think that these are the worst possible domains in which to start using an explanation facility that habitually lies, and lies so convincingly that you don't know, although you might say that's the definition of a good lawyer. That's just occurred to me. But what Barres and all, who are the Oxford team, found was that these are being disproportionately used in the high-stakes subjective domains. And the reasons for this are really obvious. It's because, A, they're often legally compelled to provide an explanation, and B, you know, their clients, their patients, etc., want an explanation, and they're not computer scientists, so they're using these LLMs that provide their own explanations, particularly chain of thought. So you find that, 38% of the medical systems they looked at use chain of thought as an explanation method, despite it being explicitly not developed as an explanation method. And this was about 25% above the average use of chain of thought across all systems, right? And a second point that's really bad about this is that when chain of thought is used to kind of rationalize 2 + 2 = 5, you can tell, most people can tell, right? Or that strawberry has 3 R's in it. But if it's a legal, you know, answer or a medical diagnosis, then most people can't tell. So these are exactly the cases where you shouldn't be using plausible and deceptive chain of thought explanations. But they are, right? So if we go back to here, what are we going to do? What are we going to do in the high stakes, non-objective, non-mathematical, semantically fuzzy domains where LLMs are increasingly, probably inappropriately, but, you know, it's going to happen, being used? So back to good old Agarwal with his wonderful paper, who has another diagram that I took out that suggests basically a spectrum, you know, that you should give a more faithful explanation for the high stakes applications and a more plausible explanation where all you're really asking is something silly, you know, like which poem is better or what do you think Janet Jackson's favorite color is or something like that. He doesn't say how we're going to do this. You know, you're back then at the problem of how do you produce a faithful explanation? And it also seems increasingly conflicted as to whether you can benchmark explanations as less or more faithful. There was a heated debate about this in Tübingen with various computer scientists saying the benchmarking approaches were rubbish. I'd quite like to have computer science input on that. So are we going to need human expert explainers? You know, as in the Platform Work Directive. This is actually a very old idea. I remember Victor Meyer-Schoenberger suggesting that there'd be algorithmists back in, when was that, Ethan? Yeah, Yvonne, help me out here. 1994, it's occasionally good being old. But, you know, where are we going to find it right now in an era when all the humans are being sacked in favor of large language models? It's, you know, self-explanatory LLMs are going to be the cheap Tony Blair approved method. Another question that never seems to get asked in these papers is what do users actually want? You know, what kind of the HCI question, if you like, what kind of explanations do they actually want? Now, again, in a completely random abuse of scientific method, I just happened to know a paper by Ruben Binns from 2018, which turned out, because I did then do a tiny bit of research, to be relatively unusual. There seems to be relatively little HCI on this. But they found, because they did these very cute experiments, that people didn't like counterfactuals, which are one of the alternatives. They thought that they were arbitrary, that they generalized, and that they subjected them to indignity. And I agree. I hate counterfactuals. Not least because you can't do much about them once you're told them. A question I think we should ask ourselves is, can the courts keep up with this? I mean, that Dun & Bradstreet, I skipped that part because too much stuff. But it's only just caught up with the idea of counterfactuals, which we've been talking about since when? When was that Sandra Vachter paper?
17?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, they've been around far, far longer than that. But I think lawyers, IT lawyers, tech lawyers have been thinking about it since 2017. So here we are 8 years later. And the CJAU has just noticed that counterfactuals exist. Gosh, wow. You know, I mean, is it going to take them another 10 years to catch up with chain of thought, which by then will have been completely exploded because the consensus appears to be that it's completely exploded already, although being extensively used. And I, yes, yeah, so I ask my usual kind of last question that you always ask rhetorically at the end of these things, which is, if this is all true, then what? You know, does it mean that large language models can't be used to provide answers relating to high stakes domains because they can't provide faithful explanations? Or if they can, you can't understand them and you can't tell if they're right. You can't benchmark them either. Or are we expecting a much higher standard, this is the Chris Reed argument, from our AIs than we are from our humans? Because, you know, again, we have lots of cognitive evidence, I think, psychology evidence, that humans don't really understand the explanations they're giving. They just post-rationalize their decisions. And I'll stop.